From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The California legislature is confronting a wide variety of issues in 2016. We'll talk to the leaders of the California legislature, the Senate's Democratic leader, Senate Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon, Democrat from Los Angeles, and the Senate Republican leader, Senator Gene Fuller, Republican from Bakersfield, to find out what's on the legislative agenda for 2016.
We'll also hear from Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta, UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe, and Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, and by Kaiser Permanente. Thrive. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. California's a big state with big challenges. Our guest is the leader of the Senate Democrats, California Senate Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon, one of those key political leaders who's tasked with addressing some of those big challenges. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So it wasn't so too long ago we were dealing with $20 billion deficits. For the last few years, though, state's been doing pretty well, been running budget surpluses. The question is, what do we do with that money? Do we restore and expand social services that have been cut? Do we pay down long-term debts? Or do we put that money into infrastructure?
A couple things I would say. I would say all of the above. Okay. Number one, we have been very fiscally sound with regards to the numbers. Right now we're in the black. We had some historic record deficits because of some federal policies that were hedge funds and derivatives, and it brought the real estate market to its knees, and the end results were some really devastating draconian cuts at the state level, where a lot of folks suffered greatly, especially in the Central Valley, because the social services net was almost just shattered. What I believe is that we have to invest in human capital. Paying down debt, we have been doing it. We've been doing it actually quite successfully. We have a rainy day fund where we have stored billions of dollars away, and we're going to continue to store some more money.
It's going to be like $10 billion.
That's the estimation for the projection for the future. We're going to still do that, but I do believe that strongly we should invest in human capital. There's no greater asset in the state of California because of our diversity than its people. And I think both strongly that we should invest in human capital along with the infrastructure that's needed for California.
Well, let me kind of talk about that for a minute. You know, we've talked a lot in the public about income inequality. So the question is, what is the Democratic answer to deal with that issue of income inequality?
Well, a couple things. One is, we're the seventh largest economy on planet Earth. So I want to put this in context. Number one is the whole of the United States of America in the aggregate. Two is China, three is Japan, four is Germany, five is France, and number six is the United Kingdom. And at number seven is the great state of California. And if you're remotely even interested, eight is Brazil, nine is Russia.
I was going to ask you.
And 10 is Italy. Now, I want to put this in context because California is a subnational. We're not a nation, but we have the seventh largest economy in the world. But when we disaggregate that data, what we look at is we see really strong deep-rooted poverty in the Central Valley as well as inland Southern California. These are parts of the state that have not felt the positive economic resurgence. So what can we do? Number one, we can actually raise the minimum wage. We have a proposal that's on the table to raise it to $15 an hour by the year 2022. We also have an earned income tax credit for those at the lowest economic strata, so they can take more capital when they file for their taxes and hopefully use that for consumer goods or for savings for their family. We can also move with intentionality public policies such as cap and trade to create jobs in the renewable space, clean energy technology spaces, I believe strongly, in areas where the jobs are needed, i.e. Central Valley. Right. You know, so these are just a number of items that we can do.
It's interesting. There's a researcher at UC Irvine that indicated that about half the workers in the Valley would benefit from an increase in the minimum wage. That's an incredible number.
But yes, 50%, absolutely.
50% of the workforce. Let's kind of switch gears. I know we're talking about a lot of things here, but let's switch gears and talk a little bit about housing, which is kind of related to poverty and those issues. A lot of talk about affordable housing. What's the Democratic solution for affordable housing?
Housing is a big issue. Listen, I represent the second largest city in the United States of America, and I represent one of the most impoverished areas in the state of California. Housing displacement has taken a real toll on working families and the working poor. And we're talking about folks who actually have jobs and live in poverty today. We have a serious housing policy issue to confront. There's no doubt about it. You look at the Bay Area, for example, and you see some folks are living what it feels like the second gilded age, if you will. But at the same time, the unintended consequences are displacement of working families. In Fresno and in Central Valley, we see the continued expansion of more developments. I think we have to be very smart with our housing policies. I think we have to relook at the rules that we currently have at the local as well as state level. I just had a very productive meeting with the mayor of the city of Fresno,
Ashley Schwaringer.
Mm-hmm. And it was a very productive meeting. We talked about cap and trade investment dollars for greenhouse gas, carbon reduction at the same time. How can we build housing in areas where we have density and couple that with public transportation, moving people from one place to another? For folks in Central Valley, that's a big cultural swing as well, too. But I believe if we want to move people to commercial centers, to parks and open space, to areas where they don't have to burn a lot of carbon, we have to rethink the way we've lived.
How we design cities.
And we have to design cities in the future. So I'm actually excited. I, per se, am not a housing expert, but there's no question about I see the biggest need. It's not just in an area like, urban area like San Francisco or Los Angeles, but in the Central Valley as well.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to find out the Senate Republican answer to some of these questions. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report.
Welcome. So what do Republicans think should be done with the state's budget surplus? Our guest is California State Republican Leader Jean Fuller. Welcome to the Maddie Report, Senator Fuller.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
I'm very happy to have you. So the state's having the good fortune of some budget surpluses, and I'm just wondering what the Republicans think we ought to be doing with that money. I mean, there's a lot of options here. Mm-hmm. One is you can expand social services or restore them, the ones that were cut. You could pay down long-term debts like the public employee retirement benefits, or you can invest in infrastructure. What do Republicans think we ought to do with the money?
Well, we think we should manage this just like we do in businesses at home. First, we believe you pay down the debts and improve your credit rating, and then you can reclaim that interest money, and you can begin to move forward on improving your infrastructure that will return an investment for your state. The investment in water infrastructure and hospitals and things that actually help people and keep people alive and attract people from other states are important infrastructures for us to invest in.
Yeah, the long term, looking at the long term.
Yes. And in the short term, of course, education, particularly those that get students jobs, shorter education, more tied to industries and universities, actually doing a better job of placement.
You know, that's very interesting. You segue right into the next question that I have, mm-hmm. and that was, you know, there's been this growing concern about income inequality. And I'm just wondering, do you see that as a product of market forces, or is there some other reason for this economic inequality? What's the Senate Republican answer to that?
Well, in our area, we think we need to be more competitive with other states, and we need to not do a one-size-fits-all economic formula for the whole state, because the coastal area has progressed faster than the inland area. The inland area is being left behind, and a lot of the regulations and slowness of permitting has really, really killed the economic competitiveness in those areas. And so as we move forward, we believe that we need to do things that will help us be more competitive, especially in those areas of high unemployment.
Right. I mean, that ties into the whole issue of poverty, too. And one of the issues there is, you know, how do you deal with poverty? You were talking earlier about education, the importance of education. And there's that achievement gap you always hear about.
Yes.
So what are your thoughts about dealing with poverty? How would you address that? And you also mentioned a lot of this problem is in the interior of California, like the San Joaquin Valley. Mm-hmm. So how would you address that problem?
Well, in our area, a lot of the unemployment is for these unrealistic and unproven state-driven mandates to change people's behavior across the state. And so what happens is that people don't change their behavior. It just costs them more, and jobs are increasingly leaving.
Can you give me some examples of what you mean by that?
Well, basically in our area, you know, we've lost competition in areas that have to do with the drought, you know, the ag
the whole
industry,
water issue.
The whole unable to grow their crops, and a lot of workers have lost their jobs in that area. We're currently not permitting safe energy production, and so all of those areas are losing their jobs.
That's a big issue in Kern County, where you're from.
It is. In the dairy industry, the ethanol price spike that came about a couple years ago has hurt the dairy industry, and yet people are not changing their behavior drinking soy milk for the most part. So we believe that the free market should drive the enterprise, and people should be allowed to make some of those choices.
You bring up something that's kind of interesting. You know, Kern County is the king of energy.
Yes,
we all know that. But what about solar energy in Kern County? Mm-hmm. Are you seeing more jobs? And we'll talk about the green jobs being created. Do you see that happening in Kern County?
Well, basically, oil and gas is 80% of the energy production for the state. For us, solar is 80%. We produce 80%, and wind is 70%. However, the ratio per energy job varies greatly. Among gas and oil, it's a much more highly skilled and more job-intensive employment than it is solar and wind. So while we value all of our energy sources and we believe we need to move forward, we don't believe that we should be making the business climate so uncertain in this state that people will not invest money in things that they believe could benefit our economy.
You know, one of the issues that's dealing with poverty, one of the reasons for poverty in California is the cost of housing. It's not so bad in the San Joaquin Valley, but around the state, that really is an issue. So what do Republicans think ought to be done to deal with the housing issue, housing affordability?
Well, we think that affordability needs to be there for especially those families that are hardest hit. We have a group of packages, some specifics are, to give tax relief to renters and disabled veterans. We have also bills to help with transportation costs and vision care. And those are some of the things we think if we make the basic daily living possible for individuals, that helps them with their housing costs.
Yeah, and I'm guessing CEQA reform wouldn't be bad either from your perspective.
We would love to have some CEQA reform. We believe that CEQA does some good things, but we think that it should not inhibit business by having an indefinite period.
You know, we're running up a little against the deadline, but I did want to ask you about crime. The governor has made this proposal on sentencing reform. Just want to get your quick comments on sentencing reform.
Well, the governor has decided to delay until after the voter registration sentencing reform, but we do believe that if there is sentencing reform, that there at a minimum needs to be mandatory rehabilitation courses with successful completion notices, which are not included in many of the legislation.
That would seem to be a pretty important point, I would think.
Well, as an old school teacher, you do not get your, you know, you're out of class until you finish your homework.
It sounds fair. Anyway, up next, we're going to turn our attention to California's long-term problems. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. So what are some of the big issues that the California legislature is going to be tackling this session? We're talking to Senate Republican leader Gene Fuller from Bakersfield. You know, the governor of the Democrats have made addressing climate change a key piece of their legislative agenda over the last couple of years. What are your thoughts on how we ought to address climate change?
Well, first, I think those things that we found are proven health risks should be the things that we're putting our money into. And one of those is clean air. And in the San Joaquin Valley, for me, it's been valley fever. And I have introduced a bill numerous times trying to get money for valley fever research so that we can help people with that impact of sort of what's going on in climate. I don't believe that we should be chasing fears. I think we should be chasing research. But then, of course, as a PhD scholar, that would appeal to me much more than it would reading the headlines and deciding that we need a policy for that.
Right, right. You know, the scientific literature does seem to indicate, though, that climate change is going to cause more severe weather patterns and, for example, more frequent and more prolonged droughts. So the governor's made a proposal, this Twin Tunnels project. I think he's calling it the California Water Fix, about a $15 billion proposal. What are your thoughts on the governor's Twin Tunnels approach to the Delta?
Well, I think that if we could get the federal government and especially the sort of Democrats in the administration and the federal government to look at the endangered species laws, look at exemptions for droughts. I mean, those things are all possible there during times of extreme emergency, which California is in. But I think that would be the best way to deal with it. But since that is not happening, and it seems that no one believes it will, then we need to have a way to look at how do we deliver water from the north to the south. And that's a difficult question in a not-my-backyard California. Having said that, there's really only a few measures that can be taken if we aren't going to increase pumping through exemptions of the Endangered Species Act. And one of them is peripheral canal or tunnels or some type of rerouting of excess water flows from the north.
I bet as long as you've been in politics, you've been hearing about water.
Well, actually, you know, since I was a small girl, I thought I married a man who owned a well, and I found out that he was a dry farmer, so.
Oops. Well, let's talk about water storage. You know, there's this discussion about above-ground storage, you know, dams, and also below-ground storage, what was called water banking. There's a question of whether or not there's enough money to do both. So if you had to pick one, which one would you pick and why?
First of all, because water is my number one priority, I would use the whole budget on water, number one.
Okay.
And that would give us enough money to go ahead and finish what we've already started, which we already have the money for, which is the Water Bond Act of 2014. And that would be above ground storage. And then I think—
There was $2.7 billion set aside for storage there.
And we need to finish that plan, which we haven't completely finished, and we need to not just subtract from it. Then I would say that it's always prudent to act for developing local, regional water, in-ground water banks for times when there is now excess water that we can store. And we need to, as soon as we finish these dams, we need to work to provide more incentives to help those development.
You know, the water experts have a term for what you're talking about. They call it conjunctive use. And they say all of the above.
Well, you know, water is one of the things no one can live without.
Right.
So I'm afraid that
it's pretty essential.
We absolutely have to make that number one on our list, because if we don't have water, nothing else really matters.
That's true. Well, let's talk about another big infrastructure project, and that's transportation. It's been reported that the state's highway maintenance backlog is about $58 billion. That's not even local roads. That's just state highways. Now, the governor has made a $3.6 billion proposal to kind of begin to address that. I'm just wondering, what do Senate Republicans think we ought to do to start addressing that $58 billion problem?
Well, actually, we've left it for far too long. Part of the reason that we've left it for far too long is that the money the taxpayers did give us was redirected, especially during the recession. So, number one, we think we need to take the dollars that the taxpayers have already given to us, put those back into transportation uses, and make Caltrans more efficient and more responsive. In other words, spend what you have more effectively. And then when we get all of those things done, I think we ought to look at some bipartisan solutions that do not include a heavy use of transit and light rail and kind of boondoggle-like high-speed rail projects.
That's a whole other topic. So we've only got about another a minute left in the segment. I want to ask you about, you know, you're kind of talking about some of the big issues in California. You know, we've got, you know, poverty, infrastructure, public employee, retirement benefits, et cetera. But we're also dealing with a very volatile tax system that seems to rely very heavily on the wealthiest citizens. And a lot of that is, you know, capital gains through sale of stocks and whatnot. Makes it very volatile. So what do you think we ought to do to make the revenue structure in California a little less volatile but still be able to pay our bills?
Well, I think we've started out with a good bipartisan effort with the Rainy Day Fund. I think that gives us some smoothing ability, and we're excited about that. I think the biggest problem is for the last 10 years or the last decade, we spent more than we took in, regardless of how much we took in. And so, number one, we aren't sticking to our budget priorities. We aren't doing basic budgeting, and we need to do that as a Californian, and we need to make that happen first, because you cannot keep chasing your revenue source. And the next is we just need to be a stable job attractor. We need to make our business climate stable and no uncertainty so that we can compete. We are the biggest economy in the United States. Why can't we level out all these ups and downs? And the reason is we're buying all these little toys and things instead of sticking to a government basic budgeting.
Yeah, I was going to lay that as a rhetorical question to ask the Senate Pro Tem in the next segment. But I want to thank the Republican leader, Gene Fuller, for joining us. Up next, the Democratic response to the state's long-term problems. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. We're rejoined by the leader of the Senate, Senate Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon. We were just talking to Senator Fuller, the Republican Senate leader, about some of the long-term issues facing the state. So one of them we talked about was climate change. last few years, Democrats have been on the cutting edge in climate change legislation. I'm wondering, are we likely to see more climate change legislation, or is the focus now going to kind of shift to implementation?
I think we need to do both. We think we need to implement and execute intelligently laws that we have passed. I think at the same time, we have to still revisit the climate change impacts and mitigation issues to the state, but in particular, for example, the Central Valley. We have the hottest year recorded in history, which was last year, 2015. We have a severe drought. We're entering the fifth year of a record drought. And right now, if we don't have no water, we have no economic growth. And if we don't have economic growth, we don't have revenue and jobs. And if we don't have jobs, then we have unemployment lines. This has an impact, irrespective of your political persuasion, whether you're Republican or Democrat. There's no doubt about it. The scientists have already spoken. This is having a severe impact on the daily lives of Americans. But bringing it back home to California, this is having even a larger disproportionate impact on the livelihoods, even if folks are unaware of it, for folks who live in the Central Valley, from Fresno all the way to Kern County.
The more severe and prolonged droughts and things of that nature.
The more prolonged droughts, which causes unemployment.
You know, it's interesting, you know, you get the opportunity to appoint someone to the ARB, Air Resources Board, and you appointed a Valley person.
I did.
Senator Dean Flores. So that was interesting, and I think representing the Valley, which is great.
Well, let me add one thing, too. Sure. Very quickly, you know, visiting the Central Valley on numerous occasions, sitting down with the Fresno Bee editorial board, I did learn a lot about the Central Valley. Mm-hmm. I'm from an urban area down in mm-hmm. Southern California. But I do respect the grit of the folks from the Central Valley, the can-do spirit. You get knocked down, you get up and clean yourself off, and you keep charging forward to fight for a better day for your family. And I thought it was important that you have someone from the Central Valley represent your interests because of the dirty air, the contaminants in the air that Fresnans, as well as other Central Valley folks, breathe into their lungs every single day.
Well, you've got a very good editorial from the Fresno Bee. They really much liked your choice.
Fantastic.
So, you know, we're talking about these long and pronounced droughts because of climate change. Governor's got a proposal to get more water, the Twin Tunnels proposal for the Delta. What do the Democrats think about that proposal in the Senate?
Well, I don't think there's a consensus as of yet with regards to the Twin Tunnels. I think it's highly controversial. There are folks who are strongly for the Twin Tunnels. There are other folks who are not for the Twin Tunnels. I think that we have to look not just at the hardware, we have to look at the software. The column is the Central Valley that brings the water down from the north to the south. Unquestionably, we have to think about this very intelligently because we're talking about billions of dollars being invested. Mm-hmm. And I know what folks talk about.
About a $15 billion project?
About $15 billion. Yeah. We've got to be very intelligent in how we do this. Mm-hmm. We've got to think about water storage. We've got to think about, you know, how we can move this.
I wanted to ask you about storage.
Absolutely.
You know, because that's a big issue.
Yes.
Certainly the Valley. Dams. There's also, you can bank the groundwater underneath. There's also conservation. So what is the answer for the supply of water? Is it all of the above, or should we focus on the most efficient and effective way to increase the supply?
I think that by far and large it's all of the above, but I think we have to be very efficient. I think we have to continue to conserve. I think conserving is the new. I think that's going to be with us in perpetuity.
A lot of my neighbors are taking out their lawns.
Yeah, we never conserved because we always had an abundance of water. Why conserve when you had water that was running freely?
Right.
In perpetuity, at least that's what many folks thought. That's no longer the case because of climate change and because of the drought. We're not sure what's going to happen next year. However, the issue of above storage and underground storage is very interesting. You can build as many dams as you want above storage. The question is the water going to come? We're elected officials, politicians. We're not scientists, nor are we shamans who can predict if the water is going to come forward or not. Why invest billions of dollars of hard-earned taxpayer money to build something if the water never comes? We have to be very intelligent. Can we conserve water? Can we have below storage
water? One of the issues
do the same thing.
Are we going to have snowpack? And then that's what would feed the dams. And one of the questions with climate change is maybe there's less snowpack and maybe dams might not be the way to go.
There's a big unpredictability. And I get it for very special, powerful interest in parts of Central Valley. They are committed and wedded until the very end to the issue of above storage. But I just want us to think about this very intelligently before we pull the trigger and move forward.
I've only got 30 seconds left
in
the segment. So many questions I want to ask you, but I want to ask you a last question on transportation. We've got $58 billion or so in highway maintenance backlog needs to be addressed.
Yes.
The governor's proposed $3.6 billion to start to begin to address that issue. What's the answer there?
The answer is we have to help build up our infrastructure, roads, local highways, as well as public transportation, bridges that are crumbling and falling apart. We need to invest in our infrastructure. When we do so, it grows the economy. We put people to work. People who live in Central Valley, from Fresno to Kern County and Bakersfield, we can put them to work. But we need Democrats and Republicans working together in concert.
I want to thank our guest, Senate Pro Tem Kevin DeLeon.
Thank you.
And Senate Republican Leader Gene Fuller for joining us. If you want to stay current on state and local politics, you can sign up for our free e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, or check us out on Facebook or Twitter, or check us out on our website at maddieandsuit.org. This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views expressed in The Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or The Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on The Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieandsuit.org.
Up next, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta, Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee, and chair of the Political Science Department at UC Merced, Professor Nate Monroe.
You're listening to The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Welcome back. So how will the California Senate's debates at the state capitol impact the Valley? We've got three viewpoints. Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times-Delta. Welcome, Paul.
Hi, Mark. How are you?
I'm going high-tech today on your computer, I understand. Bill McEwen.
Yes, I am.
The editorial page editor of the Fresno Bee. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you.
And the Tony Coelho Chair of Public Policy at UC Merced, Professor Nate Monroe. Welcome, Professor Monroe.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, so Professor Monroe, let me start with you first. We were talking in the earlier segment about how the state might want to deal with its budget surpluses. Democrats generally want to see the extra money spent on restoring or expanding social services, as well as maybe investing in infrastructure. Republicans generally are focused on paying down the state's long-term debts. I'm wondering which strategy impacts the Valley better, and for lack of a better way to say it.
I think it depends a lot on, you know, where the Democrats want to spend the money, you know, and so, you know, to take a little bit longer view. In the short run, certainly there's no shortage of problems in the Valley that money could help. Right? There's, you know, the freeways are falling apart. The you know, there's a dramatic need for increase in healthcare, you know, facilities. There's all sorts of things that money could be used to supplement. Certainly, lots of social programs. The problem, of course, is that historically, when Democrats want to spend money, more of it goes to areas outside of the Valley. And then, you know, if that surplus then isn't spent to sort of, you know, put into place some sort of rainy day expectation, then once, you know, the lean times come, the cuts, the social programs cut the deepest in the Valley. So I guess the answer to the question really has to do with whether or not one or the other of these parties is going to focus heavily on, you know, spending in the Valley.
Yeah, you know, Paul, let's talk about something that kind of does impact the Valley, and that is the issue of income inequality and the issue of poverty. You know, we've got a new minimum wage that people are hoping will alleviate or at least begin to address these problems. Some people say actually it might actually add to these problems. Opponents are arguing that there may be job losses. Proponents are saying, hey, it's going to affect a large number of Valley people. About 50% of the Valley workforce would likely benefit from an increased minimum wage. So what do you think? Do you think the benefits of a higher minimum wage are going to offset the higher unemployment that's going to result?
I do, and I've been reading a lot of research that says that raising the minimum wage does not necessarily lead to long-term or substantial job loss, nor inflation. But what it will do in the Valley, I read a really interesting story in the New York Times last week about the fact that if you raise the minimum wage to $15, which was not going to happen for 6 years, but still, you're getting that minimum wage really close to what the average wage is in the Valley, in Fresno County, in Tulare County, Kings Counties, and that sort of pushes everything up. There'll be a ripple effect there. So I think it will help the Valley. It'll put more money in people's pockets, which should help the local economy. On the other hand, I think you're going to have to be prepared for some effects through the rest of the job market.
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. You know, Bill, what about inflation? So they get this increase to $15 an hour, but then all prices increase, so they really haven't made any gains. Is that going to be a problem here in the Valley?
Well, I don't really buy that argument. I mean, the problem you have in the Valley is too many people that are poor, and they're on public assistance of some kind, whatever you want to call it, And this is an opportunity for them to get off of that and really become productive members of society. I see it as a great benefit. The other thing is, we hear about the job losses, and I'm not going to be Pollyanna. This is going to have a big ripple effect throughout the restaurant industry. And already in the restaurant industry, we're seeing the going away from service and self-ordering and those kinds of things. This higher wage, minimum wage, will speed that along. But, you know, I never hear anyone say, talk about the fact that with a $15 minimum wage, you're going to have many more applicants for jobs. In theory, employers will be able to be more selective in the hiring process. And in theory, I think they can expect more out of the employee, a more productive employee. When you're paying $15 an hour, that commands some respect both ways. So I think that this is pretty good for the Valley. This isn't exactly the way I would have done it. For example, in Oregon, their minimum wage standard, and they're very progressive there, it's done regionally. So it would take into account, you know, what the local economy looks like, and it wouldn't be one size fits all the way California's is.
Yeah,
the other thing I would have done is I would exempt students or make it a dollar or two less, those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's interesting. The Republicans were talking about having a regionally adjusted minimum wage, and the Democrats, particularly the labor unions, wanted nothing to do with that. So, Professor Monroe, let me ask you, is there a better way to address the issue of income inequality than raising the minimum wage, for example, expanding the earned income tax credit?
Well, I guess I'm not sure that the expanding the earned income tax credit is really going to do it. In terms of sort of a better way to address that, I do think that the minimum wage the increase in minimum wage is a reasonable step to take. I think that people are getting ahead of themselves, thinking that this is going to really seriously reduce the sort of the wage gap, in the sense that for some segment that's going to happen, no doubt. But it's a long way, I think, from if not job losses, then certainly some slightly depressed growth in jobs in a place where there's going to continue to be significant unemployment. And that is really, for our region, the thing that is the most problematic for the wage gap, right? It's not the people who are working that define the region's poverty. And so even if we keep all the jobs that we have no loss and no inflation, virtually, you know, that unemployment rate is going to drive the sort of problems in the region. And until we find a way to fix that, right, the minimum wage, the earned income tax credit, none of that is going to change that unemployment rate.
Yeah, just for a juxtaposition, just to kind of give you some numbers, I think the average wage in California is around $44,000. But if you look at the ag industry in particular, the average wage in the ag industry is about $26,000. So, you know, when this thing phases in, it's going to impact ag, I would think, in particular. Let me ask you this about another issue about poverty. A big issue here, Bill, connected with poverty is the cost of housing. When you take a look at poverty rates, one of the arguments in California is that one of the reasons we have high rates of poverty, about one out of four in California, people are under the poverty level, is the cost of housing. Is that really a big issue here in the Valley?
Well, it's everything's relative. Wages are so much lower here. Housing's also costs a little bit less, but it's still California standard. So, I mean, housing costs more throughout California. And I think it's a big driver of poverty here, and it's an excellent example of why we've seen these slum lords just be able to, amass all these thousands of units under a single ownership. And so I think it is a big issue. I think that the minimum wage will $15 minimum wage in 2022 is going to help the single mom that's trying to raise a couple kids and trying to pay attention to them and have them live in a decent neighborhood where they're not going to be exposed to a lot of problems and go to a good school. So it's not a panacea, but I think it's an improvement. And affordable housing is a huge issue in the Valley, regardless of the wage.
You know, Paul, I'm wondering in Visalia, do you see affordable housing being a big issue in Visalia, in the South Valley?
Well, it depends on who you'd ask. I agree with Bill that the rents in Visalia over the last two or three years have risen dramatically. And part of that is because people are renting homes now, too, because of there had been a surplus on the job market. Now building is coming back. I think still this is one of the most affordable places in, on the West Coast to live. And I don't really detect a housing shortage. You know, going back to your first question there about the government surpluses and whether the Democratic or the Republican plan to spend that money is better. If the state would focus on infrastructure development, that's going to raise all boats. That is going to help our local economy and the state economy. It's going to improve the business climate. It's going to give people jobs. And with a higher minimum wage coming in, that is going to increase prosperity for everybody.
Yeah,
I'd like to piggyback on that.
Sure, go ahead, Bill.
Because of the cost of living in the Valley and also because of state policy, growth is being directed to the Valley. Yet we're always way behind on infrastructure, and we don't get our fair share for the number of people we have now. Can you imagine what it's going to be like as the Valley continues to grow? So generally, I would say, I don't want to be an apologist for Governor Brown, but I thought his vision on the budget was quite good, which is restore some of the social safety net, put money away for a rainy day, and focus on some infrastructure development.
Yeah, Professor Monroe from UC Merced, let me ask you about another topic, crime, which is a big topic, always seems like every year, certainly this year. You know, the costs of incarceration have resulted in more community-based interventions, things like, realignment that came about, Prop 47. And while crime has been, at or near historical lows, we're beginning to see an increase in crime, particularly property crime here in the Valley. Has the move away from incarceration made the Valley less safe?
I think there's no question about it. I mean, it's a little hard. I think the statistics, as you said, they're starting to show it a little, but even those are going to lag behind. And we're really not very, a year or two out from the sort of major shifts that you're talking about. And I think there's going to be a little bit of a lag in the statistics that show, the impact of that. But if you talk to local law enforcement up and down the Valley and Fresno, Madera, Merced, Modesto, their impression is certainly that on the front line they're seeing these significant rises, and it's directly a result of some of these incarceration laws.
Yeah, it's interesting. Paul, in Visalia, it's interesting that if you take a look at the research, it indicates that in terms of a cost-benefit analysis, $1 spent on more policing has a bigger deterrent effect on crime than a dollar spent in incarceration. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on this kind of move away from incarceration, this incarceration model, to, this more community-based intervention model.
Well, the good news, there is an increase in crime, is that it is less violent gang crime now than a lot of nonviolent crime, property crime, and continued drug crime. We still have a huge drug problem here. I think that investment in innovative policing is still a lot more effective, a lot more effective investment than incarceration, and that includes building more and bigger jails. And I would say the law enforcement would agree with me on that too. I think they would rather have more resources to suppress crime rather than to keep arresting guys and then have them turn back up on the streets 18 months later in a reduced sentence.
And since you have the revolving door, so Bill McEwen with the Fresno Bay, I want to ask you about what your thoughts are on the governor's sentencing reform proposals. He basically wants to eliminate these enhancements when you're considering what the proper parole date is. In other words, just using the base crime number of years as the basis for calculating when the person's up for parole, as opposed to adding all these enhancements like, you know, being in a gang, having a gun, those kinds of things. I'm wondering, what are your thoughts? Is that good for the Valley?
So that would depend on your thought, how you view the prison system. And if you are among the many that agree that prison is finishing school for criminals, in other words, the longer they spend in there, the more likely they are to return to a life of crime, you would agree with Governor Brown. Where I would come from is that if you send people to prison without any legitimate rehabilitation program, education program, and those things, they're still going to return to a life of crime. So I think that there's this is much ado about something that's not really going to have much impact. If anybody had watched a recent 60 Minutes where they talk about how prisons are done in Germany, that was very eye-opening, because the efforts there about education and rehabilitation, and they have a lot more success than we have in the United States. Unfortunately, in California, you go to prison, it's finishing school for gang members.
Finishing school. That's
and
that. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
Mark, this is Paul.
Yeah.
Paul Hurley. And the enhancements haven't worked as a deterrent.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're supposed to be put in there. Is you know, it's supposed to deter people from being in gang, having a gun, assaulting a police officer. Well, it's not accomplishing their objective. So I think the governor is probably right.
Okay, well, more discussion on Sacramento politics and the implications for the Valley in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
You're listening to the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Welcome back. We're talking with UC Merced political science professor Nate Monroe, Paul Hurley, the former editorial page editor of the Visalia Times Delta, and Bill McEwen, the editorial page editor for the Fresno Bee, about what's happening in Sacramento and the implications for the Valley. So, Bill McEwen, let me ask you, water. Obviously, it might be the biggest infrastructure issue for the state. A lot of talk about dams here in the Valley. What do you think? Is the California legislature going to do something to make Temperance Flat and some of these dams a reality?
Well, you said Temperance Flat first, and I understand that, but I don't think Temperance Flat is first in the pecking order for the California legislature. I mean, there's $2.7 billion there. The state would put some forward. The people that would benefit from the cost of building a dam would contribute. And then there's the expectation, if Congress can ever pass a bill and get a president to sign it, that the federal government would contribute as well. So they have to rank these projects. And I think that Sites Reservoir in Northern California is well ahead of Temperance Flat. And people are starting to take a hard look at Temperance Flat now, and they're saying quite simply, you know, on average, it doesn't provide a whole lot of water. Not a big water year, it would be important. But over time, spending billions of dollars for something that would produce 70,000, 100,000 acre feet a year, that doesn't pencil.
What about raising San Luis Reservoir? I've read some things about that, you know, even environmentalists are okay with some environmentalists with raising the San Luis Reservoir. Would that be more cost?
Well, that would be a federal project, Mark.
Okay. Well, let me ask Professor Monroe. What about the federal government, you know, getting involved here, either doing something with the San Luis Reservoir or reaching some kind of agreement to make these above ground storage facilities a reality?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for what we're certainly not going to see anything until we see how the elections shake out this year, obviously. And I think that the constellation of the, you know, who controls the different, you know, chambers is going to matter a lot. It's a little surprising to me, though, that given the placement of some of the Republicans from the Valley delegation in a Republican House, that we haven't gotten closer to getting some of that done. But I, you know, again, we're talking about a divided government where sort of, you know, these issues are sort of cutting across a lot of different constituencies and a lot of different interests. And I think until we have probably sort of a unified government in one direction or another so that they can sort of internally make the compromises, we really are unlikely to see the federal government get involved, if even then.
Yeah. Paul, what about groundwater banking? That's the other big issue. You can store water above ground or below ground. Apparently, there is a lot of potential for groundwater banking. We've also seen some subsidence here in the valley where they're pumping so much the ground is actually sinking. Do you think that the state legislature is going to possibly get involved with groundwater banking and ramp that up here in the valley?
Well, I hope so. I don't see any evidence of that. I think you're right that groundwater banking has a lot more potential than surface storage. We do need some additional surface storage, but look what's happening with we sort of had a semi-wet winter. You're still losing a lot of water. Even if you had the storage, you're not going to be able to keep it all. California needs an entirely new outlook on how to provide for its water with some sophisticated technology, with some new methods of conservation. We should be imitating the methods that they're using in places like Australia and Israel, which get a lot less water than we do, but use it much better. We should be investing in a lot more technologies like desalination that would provide us with more water. But we're kind of stuck on the whole let's build another dam or not question, and maybe we need to move on from there.
Well, Bill, let's move on to another kind of water-related issue, and that's the Delta and the governor's twin tunnel proposal. Is that going to happen this year, or is this going to go the way of the 1982 peripheral canal proposal?
In my opinion, it's DOA. There are just so many environmental groups lined up against it, so many ag groups. Basically, anybody that's in the Delta, north of the Delta, there's nothing in it for them. And, Twin Tunnels goes against a state law. It was passed, I think, in 2009 that said whatever happens in the Delta will be done on a co-equal basis. So meaning co-equal, meaning more water delivery, but then also Delta restoration and restoration of the fish species and everything else. And as the governor has had to tweak and change his tunnels proposal, a lot of that restoration's gone away. And so I just don't see this happening. There's way too much opposition.
Okay, Professor.
Mark, I agree.
Okay, go ahead, Paul.
I agree that it just the property owners in the Delta alone would tie this up in courts for a generation.
So I'll let Professor Monroe be the arbiter here as the political science professor. What do you think? Political reality. Is this DOA, the Twin Tunnels project?
Yeah, I think it's DOA. I mean, if it was going to have happened, right, the momentum to carry it forward is behind us. I just think that there are, it's what we tend to think about sort of academically as a problem of, pretty concentrated costs and pretty diffuse benefits. The groups that benefit from it are not quite as loud and not quite as concentrated as the groups that are hurt. And I think the result is that there's just not enough sort of weight pushing behind it to overcome the sort of intensity of the sort of groups that are hurt by it. I just don't see it. And I think Governor Brown sort of he's going to run out of time, in reality, I think.
So this is the peripheral canal, 2.0. Anyway, let me talk about another big infrastructure project and issue, and that's roads. Anyone who travels Route 99 has a real-time experience with the state's $59 billion highway maintenance backlog. Given the importance of Route 99 to the valley, do you think the Democrats, Republicans can maybe get together and agree on a proposal that's going to include raising fees or taxes to upgrade the state highway system?
Yeah, I think that's very much in the realm of possibility, and I say that because Republicans have been hammering away at this for a long time. They're looking for something that will be populist. They're looking for a way to reconnect with voters and rebuild their party. So it's important to them. Democrats, so-called MOD Democrats, they're right in there with the Republicans. So, it's the devil's in the details. Both sides are fighting about it. But I think just like when they came together for the water bond, at some point, in California, Democrats and Republicans will agree on something that will focus more resources on basic transportation infrastructure. Now, you talk about how bad Highway 99 is, but you got to remember the state has spent a ton of money on Highway 99 in the last 10 years.
There are some very nice sections, yes.
Yes, and so there are lawmakers from other parts of the state that would say, 99's had our attention for the last 10 years. We need to spend this money elsewhere.
Now, I would argue 99, though, is the backbone of the state, but that's for another discussion. I do want to ask Professor Monroe about this change in high-speed rail. I didn't want to leave that discussion alone. They've reoriented high-speed rail to San Jose, not to L.A., and I think they bypassed Merced in the process. So being a professor at UC Merced, what are your thoughts on the proposed high-speed rail plan to build that first operating segment from North Kern County to San Jose? Good or bad for the Valley?
I think it's bad. I think it's an odd, you know, an odd move, right? So, you know, for folks in the Valley, it doesn't, the problem is, right, that for folks, people in the Valley, this promises in the short run to provide either a quick way to the Bay Area or a quick way to LA, and eventually to both. And, you know, in reality, this sort of does neither, because it doesn't run any meaningful span of the Valley. You kind of have to go to a sort of basically a central point in Kern County, you know, and then get on to go to the Bay Area. And for many people in the Valley, the drive is not significantly shorter. Whereas, at very least, you know, the criticism of the original line was that the original line was going to be sort of like Merced or Modesto to Bakersfield. And, you know, sort of the criticism was that, well, if that's the first completed line, who wants to go between those? But the, you know, the upshot of that was that the next step is that it is connecting it to LA, and then all of a sudden the entire Valley is connected to a new region that's a little bit unreachable otherwise, you know, in a timely fashion. So it's a confusing move, period, and certainly one that I think from the Valley's perspective isn't a good move.
Yeah, I think it's interesting when you take a look at the numbers, though. The numbers seem to be driving this. It's going to save about $7 billion going north as opposed to going south, and there's all these other issues in terms of construction. But anyway, I think that's a discussion we're going to be having in the not-too-distant future. I want to thank our guest, former Visalia Times Delta editorial page editor Paul Hurley, Fresno Bee editorial page editor Bill McEwen, and the Tony Coelho Chair of Public Policy at UC Merced, Nate Monroe. Thanks, all of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.